Hello, and welcome to SG Squared. Steve Gladen, the global pastor of small groups from Saddleback Church, pulls from his over 25 years of experience to encourage and equip listeners like you to lead small group ministry. So let's listen and learn together.
Welcome to SG Squared. Steve Gladen on small groups. Derek here with the main man, Steve Gladen. Steve, how are you doing, my friend? Welcome to Steve Gladen on Small Groups, SG Squared, we call it. I'm Derek, along with your other host, the man, Steve Gladen. Steve, how are you, my friend?
Doing good. Derek, good to have you back from vacation, and you were slumming over in the Hawaiian Islands, so it's good to have my partner in crime on SG Squared back. We had to do a little intro solo without Derek on the last episode. Because he was just sunning some part of his body.
I was swimming with turtles in the sea in Maui. It was incredible. Little stormy, but you know, I was just trying to get a little bit of the beach life like you get to experience every day there in sunny SoCal. But you were down there at the lobby. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Small Group Network puts on the lobby every year, right around that February zone. I will say the weather was not the most cooperative, as it was rainy for the first day, but the sun came back out and into the high 60s, low 70s for the final 2 days. But the thing that makes the lobby is not the weather, although the weather would always be nice to be, you know, in the mid 70s, like, you know, it is many times in January and February, but it's the people. And we had some of the top small group point people, some of the largest churches in America were there, along with just a whole variety of other ones. And nothing warms my heart more than two great things is when people walk away saying, I got so many great ideas from other churches, because not one church has all the ideas. And so it's a networking event. But even for me, I was able to get a couple of little nuggets that we were able to implement with our staff, our whole church staff, because I was talking to another church that was going through some similar things like us, and able to implement that. And again, if it wouldn't have been at the lobby, I wouldn't have met this person, wouldn't have had this conversation. So it was probably one of the best. And for me, for those that are listening that were at the lobby the last couple of years, I missed last year because of just a family emergency. So it was great to be back with all the peeps and have fun. And those that listen to the February or the March episode of SG Squared got to hear the panel discussion that Dave Enns, Rick Howerton, and I did on many things about small group life. So it was a fun time. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. So those of you that are interested in that, you can go up on smallgroupnetwork.com. Look at our events, and the lobby will be showing up there very soon.
Yeah, I enjoyed seeing the photos of you and so many friends there. Yeah. And we know that people don't really go there because of the weather and because it's in SoCal. They just go because it is the premier small group event in the land, right?
It's fun. It is fun, baby. If you like people, if you don't like people and you don't like networking, then I would highly recommend not to come. Unless you want to just do respite. I mean, there are some folks that come and just enjoy the conference grounds and don't attend very much, but that's okay too. We're flexible. If they just need a reason to come to SoCal, escape the snow and the bad weather and enjoy our version of winter, hey, bring it on. We'll take you.
That's right. Well, people have been asking recently, Steve, why are small groups so healthy and vibrant and amazing and large and all these things at Saddleback Church? What is the Saddleback small group difference when we compare, even churches of like size that don't seem to have small group ministries like Saddleback? So we're going to jump into, I think, about seven key differences that make up the Saddleback small group difference. And why don't you kind of set this up for us, where we're going to go with this?
Yeah, I mean, there's many commonalities across all small group ministries around the world. I mean, I've been in 40 different countries doing conferences in my career, and it's been fun to be there. But there are a lot of commonalities that are there. And when Derek and I were talking about the show, then I thought, hey, you know what? we have some unique things at in our Saddleback small groups that are distinctives. And it doesn't mean they're right, but they are distinctives that have a lot of churches have helped a lot of churches, and it's helped in that way. So we thought we'd put together seven. We had six, and then we thought, I can't end on man's number. So let's get God's number in there. So actually, there was a seventh one, so it was good. It fit very nicely. But we just want to roll through those, and Derek's going to kind of tee them up and add color commentary where he feels like. But I think these seven distinctives will help you in your small group ministry to know what you might want to adopt, what you might not want to adopt, and how you can serve your church a little bit better.
So one thing that Saddleback is often equated with is the phrase purpose-driven, throwback to Pastor Rick Warren's books. Yep. And but that also gets linked with small groups, purpose-driven small groups. So talk to us about purpose-driven small groups, not special interest groups.
Yeah, and this is a super common thing, because in the church world, God created the church in it with a system. And he created it so that you would go to temple courts, house to house, and then serving God with where you're gifted. And what is interesting, outside of temple courts, which is your weekend services, there's two groupings of people that will always exist inside your church. Some of them are special interest, which I'll define in just a second, but other ones are working on discipleship. And for us, those are what we call purpose-driven small groups. Those small groups are trying to balance the five verbs in the Great Commission and the Great Commandment. As you probably know, Jesus prayed those same five verbs in John 17. They're best summarized in the Great Commission, Great Commandment. And then obviously in Acts 2, when the church was birthed, the front half, temple courts, 3,000 get saved and baptized. But then immediately talks about the house-to-house movement in Acts 2, 42 through 47. And you see that replicated not only through the rest of the New Testament, but through the first 300 years of church history till Christianity was legalized. And so it's important for churches to know, because people always ask me, am I in a small group? And it's important for you to understand that language does matter. And so when we call a small group at Saddleback, that we're talking about those groups that are trying to work on discipleship, filling a spiritual void that people have in their spiritual lifestyle, in helping them, you know, work through fellowship, discipleship, serving, evangelism, and worship, and how that plays out in their small group and also in their own personal life. But then you have special interest groups, and special interest groups tend to be just groupings of people who overemphasize one of the verbs that's in the Great Commission, Great Commandment. So people who overemphasize fellowships, those tend to be a lot of sports and recreation groups. People always say, hey, I want to gather with people who like to do road biking, or who like to do pickleball, or who like to scrapbook, or things like that. The gifting that they're coming around is fellowship, but they're not really working on discipleship. They're building a lot of community. They're having fun times and stuff like that. And nothing wrong with those types of groups, because those tend to be great assimilation groups. Much like if you overemphasize discipleship and your church spends a lot in classes and learning about doctrine or New Testament or Old Testament survey, which are all great things to do. But these tend to be cluster people who enjoy the cognitive side of discipleship. And again, those groups and groupings of people aren't bad that enjoy that, but they tend not to have the full roundedness of what discipleship is about. Groups that overemphasize serving, can we kind of group them into care and to task? So we have groupings of people that take care of our landscape. We have groupings of people that clean the church. We have groupings of people that park the cars, that usher, that greet. Those are more task-based things. We have people that count the offering too. I mean, all the things that need to happen in the church, those are groupings of people that it's good for them to be around that gifting. But there's also care, and that's where we put support groups and recovery groups and some of our counseling groups that are there. And it's, again, it's overemphasizing that serving aspect of just saying, I'm going to take my spiritual giftedness. Missions, you tend to have local and global groupings of people that love to go out on trips, nothing wrong with that. Again, it's activation and stuff like that. And then in worship, you have the same type of choir groups, ensemble groups. You know, you can do all kinds of different things. I was in a very traditional church when I first started out in ministry, and they had a bell choir. And if you don't know what that is, very interesting, but I'm not going to take time to explain it. But the point is here is that we're going to focus on purpose-driven groups, not special interests. So other parts of the church handle all the special interest groups. I know there's lots of churches out there that say, if you're in any grouping of people, that's great. At Saddleback, we'd say that the special interest groups, when you're serving in your giftedness, or when you're a part of a grouping of people in your giftedness, a natural byproduct you get with doing that responsibility is you feel value. And when you feel value, you love to participate in that. And the same way in purpose-driven groups, or what we just call our small groups at Saddleback, they fill a different thing. They fill not only the relational side of what it's about, although you have relationships in both groupings of people, but it's more of a well-roundedness of how you're filling that spiritual void of becoming more like a follower of Jesus and working on those pieces. So one of our biggest distinctives is we'll acknowledge both groupings of people, but we'll also know that those two groupings of people fulfill different felt needs that are in the body of Christ.
One time at a church I was at, where I was the groups guy, we launched interest groups for a summer. And one of ours was a geocaching small group where people would go around and hunt for, you know, these geocache electronic things on their apps. I don't know how much prayer happened in that group, but they had a good time.
But it is a great assimilation piece. So I would never downsize the importance of those groupings of people, but I have been around the block long enough to know that you're fooling yourself if you think discipleship is going to happen there. High connectivity and high buy-in to the church. But if you're not careful, if you don't have a discipleship strategy, that just could be a weakness.
Very true. Another key ingredient of Saddleback small groups is the whole relational aspect versus multiplying, or what people call a rapid cell multiplication, which was a huge, thing several years ago, probably still is today. But talk to us about relational versus not multiplying.
Yeah, I mean, really, when you come down to this part, is you're asking the question of how do you do evangelism in small groups? And for some churches, the principle is evangelism, but the methodology behind that is what Derek was referring to as rapid cell multiplication. That means I start with one group, and in 9 months or 12 months or 18 months, we'll split into two, and then two will become four, and four will become eight become 16, then 32 and stuff like that, which I found in America works great on paper, but not in practicality. And I was raised Roman Catholic. I was raised in a military home, and I can bring a lot of guilt and a lot of power. But groups would, always say, when I was trying to get them to multiply for the cause of Jesus, because it's all about Jesus, they would always give me one or two answers. It would be, yes, pastor, that's what we'll do. And they would never do it. Or they would say, no, we're not going to do it. And they just go on their merry way. And what was interesting is that at Saddleback, when I came on staff at Saddleback, I thought, oh, multiplication will definitely work here, because I know there in parts of the globe, it will work. You have to ask yourself the question, if it doesn't work, then you might want to work on a different strategy, which I'll explain in just a second. But, when I first came on at Saddleback, I thought, hey, I'm at Mecca. I know it's going to work now. And what I found is it just didn't work. And so we did a focus group with a number of different groups and just had somebody else come in and ask the questions. And basically it was, why don't you want to multiply? Why is it? And when you get the pastors out of the room, you finally get some truth in there. And what the focus groups came back with a while back ago was that it wasn't this exact phrase, but it was this meaning behind it. But they would say, this group is thicker than my blood relatives. This group means more to me than my family. And what happened was, is that when you look in our society, I'm predominantly talking about a North American society where divorce has wrecked the family unit, where, single parent or I should say blended families are rampant across their stats. And my book, Planning Small Groups with Purpose, I put all kinds of stats in here about this. But, you know, and then you have five different things that they're kind of eroding the family. And obviously divorce and blended families, those are big ones. But if you live in a military community and you're moved around all the time, that shatters the family system. If you your kid's going to college out of state, which both my kids did, and you run the risk that they're going to meet somebody and then they're going to marry them, and then they're moving away from your family unit, which is happening to our family, because my daughter is and her husband-to-be are going to be launched and locked and loaded in Nashville. But they're moving away, and it's a fracturing of the family unit. And then the same thing, can happen in the corporate America because people will move around. And what can happen in that is that what your church's experience is a fragmentation of what the family unit was designed for by God. And so when people get into small groups and they find this, what biblical community is all about, they don't want to do that. Now, here's the problem. The principle we said was evangelism. If rapid cell multiplication doesn't work, then what's your strategy? And one of our key distinctives is we'll tell a group, you can stay together as long as you like. But there's two things that we put in play. One is we put personal evangelism super high, what we call one life, and that every person needs to know who's the one life, the one person that lives close to you around Saddleback Church that doesn't know Jesus that you're actively jumping into. And that one life is a critical piece that your group holds each other accountable to say, you know, how are we doing in personal evangelism? The other thing that's true about our strategy is that, you know, because people start relationally, it's hard to get out of a group sometimes, and, or it's awkward. And so that's why we do a church-wide campaign one time a year. And we'll just say, hey, if God's brought two new friends to you, you know, step out of your group, but you can always come back to it. And they never do. But the big point behind this is that we're always focused on taking the relationships deeper so that true discipleship can happen, but not sacrificing the ability to do evangelism.
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard you talk about why you don't push the rapid cell multiplication. It was like a revelation. I mean, we live in such a fractured society, especially talked about divorce and the breakdown of the family. You finally get people in a small group where they've bonded and they're doing life together and they're finding a family because theirs is broken. And then you're saying, oh, now I want you to break up and start all over. And that's the worst possible, thing that some people could hear is why are you forcing me to leave? So love the relational piece there. Verse.
Yeah, if I could even jump in too, is that some of the toughest things in discipleship, because when discipleship is speaking truth into people's lives, and the only way you can speak truth is you've got to be a trusted source. And the only way you're a trusted source is if you spend time with them. So the longer your group can spend together, the more trusted they become to each other so that you can speak the hard things of life into them, and which is what discipleship is about. It's when truth is going to intersect your scope of life and how you want to behave and work that through. And we've seen that happen in our group many times where people change behavior because we're able to speak truth into their lives and they trust us. But that can't happen if your group is getting shuffled all the time.
Well said. Let's talk about growth by campaigns versus disrupting community. One thing Saddleback's really known for is your campaigns, which I'll let you tell people what that is. But often in small group world, you hear the word campaign, you think about Saddleback. So talk to us about these growth by campaigns.
Yeah, and I kind of referred to it in the last statement right there when we were talking about multiplication and how do you do that in small group ministries. and how we'll focus a little bit more on personal evangelism and the relationships. One of the things that it's kind of like a cousin to it is of that last distinctive is our church-wide campaigns. And what we have found is that an event one time a year that pushes your church towards total alignment. And by total alignment, I'm talking about children's, students, and adults all focusing on one major theme. And in my book, Small Groups with Purpose, chapter 17, I talk about 12 ingredients of a campaign. Now, I say that till I'm blue in the face because I talk to a lot of churches about doing a church-wide campaign. And some of them will call me up and say, man, it was the most life-changing thing that happened inside of our church with small groups. And some will say, hey, you know, Steve, it sucked. And when I do the diagnostics on it, I find out they didn't do all 12 ingredients. So in my books, I talk to you about, you know, how do you build a church-wide campaign? And you need those 12 ingredients. It's kind of like if you buy a cake mix and you go, I don't feel like putting eggs in, or I don't have baking soda, I'll use baking powder. And the cake doesn't come out. Can't blame Betty Crocker. And you can't blame me, on this. So I encourage you to learn more about it. But the premise is this, is that you want to bring intense focus and alignment in your church for a 40-day window so that you can bring your children, students, and adults all online about a relevant topic inside of your community so that you can make a huge impact. And when you do, when you slow down the calendar and when you get the children, students, and adults all doing the same thing, and when you have a curriculum-based thing and you have people, you know, grab a couple of friends that are impacting them or that they run with, so that you can do this church-wide campaign, what it does is it brings such intense focus inside of your church that everybody's on the same page. And you go through the five learning styles of where people engage in each aspect of the campaign. So some people learn through the mouth gate, and those are the people that enjoy the weekend sermon. So a weekend sermon is a key component of a church-wide campaign. Some people learn through the eye gate, which is being able to, I'm sorry, the ear gate is with listening to the weekend messages. The mouth gate is discussing in small groups, which is another component of the church-wide campaign. The eye gate is reading a daily devotion, which is helping people learn through that medium. Some people are tactile and they like to do a project. So we have a project in each one of the church-wide campaigns. And some people just love to learn through stimulating their mind through scripture memory. And so we have a scripture memorization piece. Now, not everyone loves to learn through each one of those five modes of learning. However, that it does touch everybody in your congregation. And what you're doing is you're designing a centralized theme. You're using the components of the weekend message, small groups, and daily interaction, along with these other five learning modes, to be able to take your church into through a high growth moment of learning about things through a small group. Now, what makes this powerful for small groups is all the components that are happening in the church-wide campaign go through your small group ministry. So the only way people can be a part of the next 40 days of your church is through a church-wide campaign. And when you have a church-wide campaign that you're working on, what happens is that you're setting in a rhythm for people to know this is when we're launching groups. This is when we're capturing everybody to take them to that next phase of where we want them to go. And in that design, which we're going to talk about a little bit later on, is in leadership potential on the next point, is that the church-wide campaign with a undergirding of how we do multiplication and how we do leadership development all works together to help your church have a focal point. It's like creating the Super Bowl every year. The 51 weeks prior to the launch of the campaign are all talking about the importance of being in community. The church-wide campaign is the instrument that makes people wake up and go, hey, if I'm not in this, then I'm going to miss out. And so it'll help them get into a small group. In our next point, we'll talk to you about how to make it easy to get them into a small group.
Yeah. And each church that I was doing leading groups in, when we did a campaign, it was always the most energetic time of momentum with groups. In fact, in one church, the momentum was so great and awesome that I thought I had the brilliant idea. We won't just do this once a year. We'll do it every semester for groups. And I would not recommend that because then we started to see the momentum go down because it's doing a good thing too many times. Once a year is key, right, Steve?
Yeah, now I'm glad you brought up that point. Also glad you brought up the point is that in a campaign, you'll start at one level with your groups. You'll jump way high in buy-in, and then you'll settle into who's going to continue on, which is the day 41 strategy, which is also talked about in the churchwide campaign. So the first time we did a churchwide campaign, we had 826 groups. The campaign took us up to about 2400 groups. We settled in at 1400. You could look like we gained 700 groups or that we lost. I can't do the math from 22 to 1400. The point is that you can focus on what your gain is or what your loss is. And we always choose to focus on the gain because when you do a campaign every year, the people who didn't decide to continue on with their group, the beautiful thing is that if you do the campaign the next time, they're more likely to jump in because you let them jump out after the campaign. Lots in the 12 points. I could do a whole show on that, but I encourage you to go back and read chapter 17 in Small Groups with Purpose. Or if you're an all access member in the Small Group Network, you can watch the course for free on how to do a churchwide campaign. And so we have all kinds of resources.
Next, let's talk about leadership potential versus not having proven leaders or proven leaders. And talk to us about this HOST strategy, which is an acronym, which is, to me, is one of the geniuses of the Saddleback Small Group strategies, this HOST acronym.
Yeah. So what Derek is referring to is when I first came on staff at Saddleback, people who wanted to lead a small group had to fill out an application. They had to go through an interview through us. Then they had to go to our leader training. And then once they completed all of that, then what could happen was, is then we would say they could be a small group leader and we would have people that would sign up saying they wanted to be in a group. And then we became the biggest eHarmony matchmaking system of a bunch of leaders over here and a bunch of people who wanted to be in groups, and we would matchmake them. And I had, I think at the time I had 3 full-time people. All they did throughout every week was matchmake people to get them into groups through our high growth times. And what we learned when we did our first churchwide campaign is that words matter. That's one of the ingredients that you'll hear about, because when I first came on staff, we called a small group leader a divisional leader. Divisional pastor. Now I'm thinking about it. And it just scared people away. They didn't know what that meant. They didn't know what the term meant. They just going on, I don't want to be that. Then we went through a time where we said we called them shepherd leaders and nobody in Orange County knew what a shepherd was. Then we called them small group leaders and nobody wanted to be the leader. But what Derek was referring to is we said, told people, if you can just host a group, and it does stand for an acrostic. And what it does is it's the very lowest entry level of our leadership. And it is, the H stands for, do you have a heart for people? Do you like people? If you don't like people, don't lead a group. The O is, can you open up a place? And it doesn't have to be your place. It can be a coffee shop. It can be at your work. It can be in the park. It can be anywhere. I always joke, and not joke, I mean, it's a reality, is that we have a group that meets on Alaska Airlines at 35,000 feet. They do it on their long hauls. We have a couple groups that meet on yachts. We have a couple groups that meet on trains. And so, you don't care where they meet. We have some groups that meet on campus, some that meet off campus. You don't care where they meet, but open up a place. The S is just be able to serve a snack, because food makes the groups go round. And then the T is, can you turn on the video, whether you're streaming it or however you're accessing, it brings the master teacher into brand new groups so that you can know that theologically they're on track. Now, the great thing about this is that our leadership potential is we take it off of what Jesus did with the disciples. In Matthew 4, the only requirement for a leader was follow me. And that's a pretty low bar for being a disciple of Jesus. But 3 years later, it was die for me. And if you're if you understand that the Bible is written on a family system, and I could talk to you forever about that too, is that you understand that the way you raise your kids in a family is much similar to the way you raise leaders in your church. And you don't front load all the education. I didn't sit my daughter or my son down when they were five and tell them everything they were going to experience in the next 18 years. I gave it to them in bite-sized increments as God opened up doors and learning opportunities for them. And so when we're talking about leadership potential, the highest qualification of a leader, and this might be a good exercise for you to do if you're listening or if you're watching this video, is to ask yourself the question, what's the number one qualification for somebody to lead a group in your church? And for some of you, you may come up with faithfulness or teachability or follower of Christ or a number of great qualities in the fruit of the Spirit or in leadership development. All those are wonderful. But what we would say and ask you to change your momentum on is that the number one qualification for leadership is, do you have followers? And the modern term for followers is friends. And what we found is that we can magnify leadership development if we give them relevant curriculum that can help them attract their friends. So for example, if we have a young couple with young kids, we have a starter curriculum called How to Raise Your Kids Without Raising Your Blood Pressure. And that's a great, it's a very relevant curriculum to help them be able to say, I'll gather my friends to be able to do that. We have one for teenagers called How to Raise G-Rated Kids in an X-Rated World. We have one on singleness, you know, and talking about, you know, the power of being single. And the great thing about relevant curriculums is that what it does is it unleashes them to grab their friends. Now, I refer back to it real quick that's the highest thing we look for, because we have found people who may not even be followers of Christ, but they're willing to use our video curriculum to gather their friends, then that is a way for us to get them on our leadership development pathway. Do they need Jesus, or do they need training, or do they need both? And because what you're trying to do is identify leaders, the people with influence. And there's a lot of powerful things that can happen with that, because one of them is I've had a bunch of people saying they're a leader, but then it's my responsibility to fill the group. And that's a problem. And you create a governmental system when you're always filling groups. I'm not saying you can't fill groups, but if that's your primary way of getting people into groups, I think it's a dangerous zone for you to be in. What you want to do is release it to the power of the people to grab their friends. And now I'll have pastors get all freaked out about that, because the moment I say someone who's not a believer, who's gathering their friends to watch our video curriculum, they get freaked out about it. And I always come back to say, the great thing about non-believers grabbing their people to watch, you know, relevant curriculum is that their friends are probably not believers. And that could be evangelism happening in your church. But the other thing, usually what I tell a lead pastor is, if I said that could two or three non-believers sit in the back row of your church on a Sunday and listen to your message, and every pastor goes, oh my gosh, you bet. And then if I say, would it be okay if they went out to lunch and talked about it? And they would say, that'd be great. What we're describing in our host strategy and going not with proven leaders, but potentials, much like the disciples, but pouring into them, then what I'm describing is the exact same thing. And so one of our strategic things in our small group ministry is we do lower the bar, but we have guardrails in place in our leadership development strategy that help people not take their group four wheeling too much and not going off roading, but staying on track. So there's lots of pieces with that, but it is a distinctive that I will tell you, I'd lived on both sides. We interviewed everybody and stuff like that. And you know, the thing that was interesting, Derek, I don't even know if you remember this from when you were on staff at Saddleback, but a lot of times in our church discipline, what is always common with people is that in church discipline, in our small group ministry, they tended to be followers of Jesus and they tended to be members of the church. And just because you're a follower of Christ doesn't stop you from being stupid in life. And so, but again, if you have the things in place in your small group ministry, this strategy will be eye-opening for you.
That could be a great tweet. Being a follower of Christ doesn't keep you from being stupid in life. Steve Gleed. Oh, when I was a young youth pastor, I remember being part of a church where they were trying to launch small groups, you know, kind of in a campaign style. But the pastor, I guess to put it nicely, was very into the details. And yeah. I remember he had this huge map of our city on the wall, and he had graphed off where everybody lived and was placing them in the groups he wanted them in based on their address, you know, so no group got too big or too small. And in short, it was so forced, and because, you know, people weren't naturally coming together, it was just everything was so controlled. So let's talk about ratios, not size, and how one of your ingredients is you do the opposite of that.
Yeah, because one of the things people always ask is how big can my group get? And we will say from 3 to 33 or, you know, 66, you can grow your group as big as you like. Because one of the things we'll always die on is not the size of the group, but the ratios inside the group. And let me park this in two different camps right here. One of them is just on the face, on the front facing, you know, there are people who are small group leaders that will only gather 6 or 8 or 10. My small group is that. We have never been over 10. We've never been under 6. It's our group has just always been like that. Nothing wrong with that. It's just who we are. But there's also other group leaders. They're what we call natural gatherers. And they could be in the middle of Arizona desert on the hottest day, 110 degrees, and they're starting their small group up around a cactus, and they'll gather 20, 30, 40 people. It's just, they are gatherers. People just want to be around them. And at Saddleback, we have a number of groups that are 30, 40, 50, sometimes 60 in size. And first off, that tells you that the people's houses is way too big. But that's an envious spot. But the thing is that what I led with on the other part is we'll die on the hill, not of the size of the group, but of the ratios inside the group. And so what we're teaching people is how to subgroup by gender. And if you have a group of 20 or 25, and you subgroup by gender into smaller groups in the house, you'll do two things. One is you'll deepen people's discipleship, because when you subgroup by gender, genders will grow deeper in who they are in Christ. Our group has been together for decades, but there's some things that the women only want to talk about, and there's things that the guys only want to talk about. And so that's super important for you to understand. The other piece with that too is that not only do you deepen the genders through discipleship, but also you raise potential leaders, because every little subgroup needs to be run by somebody. And I can remember going to some groups, some of our groups when I was more in the field, in Cota de Casa, where, you know, some monstrous homes there, and they would have, you know, 30, 40, 50 people at their house for small group. And I would talk to someone who's leading one of the subgroups, and I'll say, oh, is this your group? And they'll go, oh, no. This is, you know, and they would say the people's names, house, it's their group. And I'd go, really? I go, so what do you do in your subgroup? And they'd walk around out how they build fellowship, how they're working on discipleship, how they're trying to empower people to serve in their giftedness, how they're holding true to their one life and helping, you know, people understand that evangelism needs to be relational and real, and that they'll worship together periodically, sometimes outside the home that they're at. And the funny thing is I'm like, well, but you're not the group leader. And they go, oh no. And so, you know, people don't want that title, but they're happy to do it. And so one of the strategies is just understanding that if you have a gatherer, let them gather people, but just teach them how to raise leaders inside their grouping. Don't get lost on trying to split the group up or make it divide, because your job is you want discipleship to happen. You don't care if it's in a large group, small group environment, or whatever environment it is. So don't be the small group police. Don't jump in on them and tell them what they need to do, but do help them learn that the only way discipleship is going to happen is if they're in smaller groupings of people.
Well said. Smaller groupings of people. So good. Now let's talk about strategic care versus not equal care. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this goes into the coaching model. And these last two distinctives are purely about the coaching model. And I just encourage it. Derek and I did a podcast called Reimagining Coaching that could help you walk through the details of this. You can look it up wherever you listen to your podcasts. But this first part of this is strategic care, not equal care. And one of the things is that I learned is that not all groups are in the same place. And so what we do at Saddleback is that we put our groups into four buckets. Well, one of them is personal care. These tend to be brand new groups that need lots of care and attention. The enemy's always trying to destroy those groups from getting traction. And so it's important that you give these groups, I'm sorry, I messed up again, got ahead of myself. It's called priority care. You want to give them priority care because they're new and they need lots of touch points because they're a brand new group. And this is true, especially during a church-wide campaign when you're starting lots of new groups. You need lots of touch points with people to be able to help nurture them. Another bucket in our care system with our groups is understanding personal care. And these are people who have taken our leader training one, haven't quite grasped all the concepts, but we're helping them understand those pieces of what it means to work on spiritual health and other certain dynamics inside your small group. The third bucket of people that we have is more of our veteran care. And these are people who have done both our leader training one and our leader training two and have a little grasp on our system. And they're more of our veteran group leaders. They've been around for a while. They don't need any care, but they sure do need to know who to go to in case they do need it. And then the fourth bucket is more persistent care. So we have priority care. We have personal care. We have phone care for our veteran people or however they want to interface with us. And then persistent care. And these are the groups that, you know, just sometimes they're not getting back to you. You're just trying to figure out, are you a P1 or are you in the first bucket or the second bucket or the third bucket? And it's kind of like a holding bucket in order to get them to know how to work with them. Because each one of those buckets needs a different level of care. And in the first two buckets, they need more proactive care. That means you are engaging with them. So if you're in a priority bucket or a personal bucket, what we call P1 or P2, we want to make sure we're doing proactive care to you. Our P3s, which is the phone care or the persistent care, those two buckets, and it doesn't matter what you call these buckets or whether if you have three buckets or five buckets or six buckets, it's just we landed on four, but those last two buckets give more reactive care. And that means when they have issues, they'll kind of raise their point with us. And so it's just important to understand that when you're building a coaching model, different people need coaching at different levels, but there always is a point when they need to come to you. And again, if you think through a family system, you're doing more intensive care the younger your kids are. You're more proactive. You're with that. But the older your kids get, the more you're starting to go more to reactive. They know where you're at. I can think of my son who is in college and, you know, we don't hear from him all the time and we don't interface with him, you know, as you want to, as much as you, as a parent, you want to engage with your kid. But also there's many times he'll call me at in the early hours of the morning on a school project or different things like that, because he knows where he can go to. And so the thing I would say to you is, so often we do the same care for every group. Just think through this. And then again, in chapter 14 of Small Groups with Purpose, I talk about this much more, about the buckets and how we utilize them and how we take people to that next level.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, Steve, take us home to number 7. And this is one you kind of added here late, so I'll let you read the title.
This is my audible call to Derek, and I'm going, hey, let's do this. This is part of this. But this one is, it takes a village, not one person. And this is the piece where, again, referring to coaching, not only do you do, you know, different care for different buckets of where groups are at, of where they're at, you also have to understand that just as in a family system, if you're a parent, you understand this line, it takes a village to raise your kid. And in the same way, it takes a village to raise a healthy small group. And one of the things that I encourage people to do is talk about every aspect in your small group ministry and every person that interfaces with your small group leader. And that could be people and that could be things. So like in the people side, senior pastor, they play a key role into the development of your small group leader. The small group pastor does, your community leader or your coach, whatever you call them, peer-to-peer learnings. Those are all different personal, those are all people-oriented things that have an influence on side into your small group leader. But there's also things that you do. Training also impacts how your leader behaves. Your small group newsletters are one ways that impact your people. Social media impacts your people. There's many different things that you do as a church, both physically things or people. So people or processes that will impact them. That whole village that you line up. And if you want more details on this in planning small groups with purpose, this is how often I've answered this question. Page 143, there's a diagram that I put in there for what we feel is our village. But my point for you to understand is, just like in your physical parenting, if not everybody in the village is reinforcing the same values that you have for your children, that's a problem inside your village. And in the same way, inside your small group village that's helping with your small group leaders, you want everything saying the same thing. And for us, it's talking about balancing the Great Commission, the Great Commandment, those five verbs. So again, it is a tactical piece that you've got to identify what are all the pieces that speak into your small group leader, and then how are they all aligning and saying the same thing?
Well, there you've got it. 7 key ingredients of the Saddleback small group difference. And we really hope this episode encouraged everybody watching or listening. We hope this better equips you to build healthier, more engaging small groups. Mm-hmm. And Steve, any final words before we call it a show?
Yeah, just remember that your small group ministries will always have distinctives and commonalities across the board, and just figure out what works best for you and inside your culture. Every culture is a little bit different. But again, if we can help you out, I'm available, and my cell number and my email are all on every one of the social media channels. So you can feel free to find me any way you want to, but we're here for you.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Again, we hope you enjoyed this episode. And until next time, goodbye.
See you guys.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And to dive in deeper, get more resources, or join the Small Group Network, just head over to smallgroupnetwork.com.